This is a production of Cornell University.
Let me begin. I'll be sort of the MC. So I want to begin by thanking our sponsors for this event, and that's the English Department, Africana Center, the Minority, Indigenous, and Third World Studies, WISE Fellowship, Creative Writing, the Creative Writing Department, and the Society of Humanities. And I also wanted to thank my colleague, Mary Pat, for helping out with the logistics and just the vision, and also Sarah, who, you know, our events coordinator. What I thought we'd do first, you know, there are a lot of student organizations that are doing really good work, you know, and I thought it would be good to start the occasion by allowing them to come and spend 5 minutes each and talk about their work. And the first organization is the, I don't know if they're here, the ICASA, people from Ithaca College. All right, so that's one. actually, that's my first joke. then also the Pan-African scholars here at Cornell. And Fatima Farah will be talking about them. And then just to give you an idea of what's coming, I'll introduce Professor Ann Adams, who then will introduce Dirango Wachanga, who is will be showing the documentary, Professor. You know, and then after the documentary, the documentary is about me. No, it's about my father. you know, so, and then they'll come and the three of them will have a conversation. And then we'll have a Q&A, and then a book signing, and a reception. And I guess that's it. Shall we have Fatima Farah please come and talk about the Pan-African scholars here at Cornell?
Hello, everyone. It's nice to see you here. I'm sorry the Ithaca College African Students Association couldn't be here, but I'm not sure if any of you have heard of their photo campaign, which was put in CNN, and they do amazing work as well. But first of all, I'd like to say thank you to Professor Mukoma for inviting me here to speak about the Coalition of Pan-African Scholars, which is a student organization that I'm a part of here at Cornell. We call ourselves COAS, and the main thing that we do is we aspire to foster strong solidarity amongst Pan-African people, scholars, and those who are interested in African culture and development issues. And as a coalition, we hope to create awareness of the rich cultural diversity that we have in Africa and history in the present state as well through our programs and events and collaborations with other groups and institutions here on campus and outside of Cornell. And COAS also aims to be a unifying organization amongst the student groups here on campus and the departments including Africana and the Institute of African Development here at Cornell. And some of the events that we hold on campus include film screenings, such as, I'm not sure if any of you have been to the one last semester for the film Sincerely Ethiopia. And we also hold weekly Africa Week celebration, annual Africa Week celebrations inside the spring, which include the Africa Ball and the fashion show, which a lot of students and staff are able to come to. And also an event that we held this past Africa Week was Fafanua L'Afrique, which was an African story. We wanted departments, people across a lot of disciplines here at Cornell to speak about an African story. One of our beliefs is that the story of Africa in popular media is incomplete, and we wanted people here at Cornell to be able to experience something different. And actually, Professor Dagmawi Wubshet, who is here moderating today, was able to speak, and he gave a wonderful presentation. And you may have noticed that in our title we have Pan-African, because we strongly believe in Pan-Africanism, the uplifting of people of African descent all across the world. And hopefully next year you'll be able to celebrate with us our 10th anniversary. It's something that we will be holding inside the spring, and please come check out some of our events for the next year. Thank you very much.
You know, and just to say another thing about the ICASA, their campaign, the Africa is not a country. If you Google it, actually, they have been featured on CNN and so on and so forth. You know, spreading awareness about Africa, so you can check them out regardless. You know, yep. Professor Ann Adams, is a faculty member of Africana Studies, has been a faculty member of Africana Studies for 24 years, with a joint appointment in comparative literature for much of that time, and since 2006 is Professor Emerita of Africana Studies and Comparative Literature. Her areas of teaching, research, and publication have been African and diaspora literatures with emphasis on Black women's writing and on Afro-German writing. Memorable among her guest sergeants and lectureships at numerous African and European universities was her 1980 visit at the University of Nairobi, at which time the Department of Literature was chaired by Professor Goge's close collaborator, Meshere Mugo. After retirement from Cornell, Adams served for 5 years as director of the W.E.B. Du Bois Memorial Center for Pan-African Culture in Accra, Ghana. Since returning to Ithaca, Professor Adams has published among work a Festschrift for Ghanaian Feminist, Essays in Honor of Ama Atta Edu at 70, A Reader in African Cultural Studies, that was in 2012, to which Professor Goge contributed. She is currently preparing a second book of Afro-German writings in English translation. Please welcome Professor Anne Adams.
Thank you. As Mukoma said, the first component of the program will be a film that will be presented by Dr. Ndirango Wachanga, who is a documentalist with interest on the archaeology of memory and memory preservation. He holds a PhD in information science from the University of North Texas. He is an associate professor of media studies and information science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Wachanga is the authorized documentary biographer of Professor Ali A. Mazrui, who is certainly a longtime faculty member, adjunct faculty member here at Africana, and was an A.D. White professor at large as well. Dr. Wachanga is also the authorized documentary biographer of Professor Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. His documentary projects seek to preserve East African memory by capturing raw voices using visual and audio technology. By creating an open access repository of the interviews, his project democratizes production of and access to knowledge. His work has been presented at Yale, Princeton, Rutgers, Witwatersrand, where he and I both were last week, SUNY Binghamton, University of North Texas, University of South Africa, and Universitat Abat Oliba in Barcelona, Spain. Wachanga's expertise has been sought by the U.S. State Department, and he has appeared on Voice of America and BBC to discuss media, ethics, and technology. He has written for media in different continents. His academic work has appeared in peer-reviewed journals such as the Journal of Mass Media Ethics, Journal of Media Studies, and African Communication Research. So I present to you Dr. Ndirango Wachanga.
Thank you so much. I just want to provide you with a brief account of how I ended up picking my cameras and following Professor Mazrui and Professor Ngugi Wa Thiong'o for the last 7 years. When I was working on my dissertation, I was intrigued by the question of information ethics and information warfare. I wanted to use underground media in my country, Kenya, as a case study. When I went back, I realized that the pamphlets that were being published were not available. Those who consumed those pamphlets would burn them. Some of the professors who were behind this clandestine media, some of them have died. Some of them survived detention, but they have not been willing to share the experience. Not that they have denied participating in this movement, but they argue they do not have the right grammar, vocabulary, and language to capture the spirit of the movement. So that memory has been suppressed, but it is available. So I went to Zimbabwe, and I interviewed an ex-soldier who confessed to me that before Zimbabwe became independent in 1980, there was a lot of movement in police stations, in military stations, in television stations, in radio stations. People are busy wheeling away boxes full of documents. Shredders in government offices were working overtime. The government was busy paying people to work overtime. The shredders could not match with the amount of those documents. They had to turn to the crematorium. They cremated those documents. And I asked him, "Do you know what was destroyed?" He said, "Our past." I went back to Texas and started reading about memory. I started asking myself, what happens when memory is suppressed? What happens when memory is available but is not accessible? I picked my camera, started following Professor Mazrui, because there was no archival information about the data I was looking for. I turned to testimonies because I was hoping that by looking at their autobiography, I would be able to understand the biography of my own region. Both him and Professor Ngugi were so accommodating. I was just a young man, maybe innocent and naive, because once I started doing these interviews, the information was so overwhelming, and it has become such a challenge of how do I really handle this information. I'm so glad that this institution was kind enough to invite me to come and share with you two of the projects that I've been working on. The Mazrui documentary is finished. I'll be launching it this summer. The Ngugi's project, I hope, will be able to launch it by the end of the year. As Professor Adam said, we just returned from South Africa, where we were celebrating 50 years since the publication of Ngugi's Weep Not Child. So one of the video clips that I'm going to show focuses on that period until when Ngugi wrote his first novel. I think it was the second novel, but it was the first one to be published, Weep Not Child, which grapples with the dreams of independent Africa, but at the same time is a sad novel because there is tension of the generation emerging from the violence of colonialism, but at the same time a privilege of the education of the same regime which Professor Ngugi embodies. The second clip, it's 10 minutes long, focuses on language. So I have different voices, and Professor Ngugi's argument on the importance of language serves as the axis around which these narratives revolves. So we'll watch the clips now.
We will now move to a conversation among the three scholars that you see before you. I've already introduced Wachangu, and the moderator of the discussion will be Cornell's own Dagmawi Wupshet, who is an associate professor of English here. He is author of The Calendar of Loss, Race, Sexuality, and Mourning in the Early Era of AIDS, which is forthcoming this year from Johns Hopkins Press. And he is co-editor of Ethiopia, Literature, Art, and Culture, a special issue of Kalalu from 2010. Dagmawi's work has also appeared in Transition, in Nka, Journal of Contemporary African Art, Art South Africa, and in African Lives, an anthology of memoirs and autobiographies. In 2010, he was named a young global leader by the World Economic Forum, and his other honors include a faculty fellowship at the Institute of Ethiopia Studies at Addis Ababa University in 2010, and the Robert A. and Donna B. Paul Award for Excellence in Advising in 2012. He received his PhD from Harvard University and his BA from Duke. An itinerant scholar, he divides his time among Ithaca, New York City, and Addis Ababa. This introduction that I wrote has all been superseded by the marvelous film. And so it gives me an opportunity to share one of the most poignant experiences that I think anybody could see to demonstrate Ngugi wa Thiong'o's his conviction about the importance of African languages and of writers nurturing and developing African languages. In 1988, there was a symposium in Berlin put on by the Writers Association of Germany. The theme was Germany seen from the outside. They invited a number of writers, largely from the Southern Hemisphere, the African and diaspora writers included Chinua Achebe, Maryse Condé, Jean-Marie Adjafi from Côte d'Ivoire, Miriam Tlali from South Africa, and of course Ngugi wa Thiong'o. Each of those writers had been invited, had been asked to submit his or her talk beforehand, in writing, so that the organizers could have the talk translated and given as handouts to the German audiences. Ngugi, this is the 1980s, at the time when he had made the decision to write in Gikuyu. He submitted his text in Gikuyu. The hosts hired a Kenyan graduate student to translate it into German. And so, at the time when Ngugi stepped up to give his talk, the German audience had copies, they could follow along, and he said, "I'm going to give my talk in Gikuyu. The question and answer period will be conducted in English." And he gave his talk in Gikuyu. Needless to say, his fellow African writers were frustrated, to say the least. Buchi Amacheta, how could I have forgotten her? She put on histrionics, walked out. Achebe sat there and kind of shook his head. Maryse Condé was also frustrated. And when he finished speaking, he said, "I will take questions and answer them in English. We have here there were interpreters who could interpret into and from English as well as French." Chinua Achebe asked him, "My brother, why would you do this? You know how rare the opportunity is for us African writers to come together. It's only when we are invited by rich Europeans and Americans to come together that we even get to talk to each other. And here, you don't even talk to us." And Ngugi answered, this is not verbatim, but certainly the idea. He said, "If I were Swedish and had submitted my paper in Swedish, my hosts would have had an interpreter from Swedish here to interpret as I spoke. We African writers have to demand the kind of accommodation and respect for our languages that European languages get. This is why I," and he acknowledged that the cost to his fellow African writers, but his point was, I think, very well made. So, since my introduction, since I don't have to give the facts about his life that I would have otherwise given in the introduction, I am glad to have this opportunity to demonstrate what I think is what drives Ngugi's activism as a writer and a public intellectual. I'll just make one or two other comments that were not covered in the film. I don't know if it was made clear that his works eventually forced him into exile, which lasted for 22 years. Most of that time he spent in the U.S. Teaching at Yale, at New York University, and going in 2002 to the University of California at Irvine, where he is a distinguished professor of English and comparative literature and the director of the International Center for Writing and Translation. And by the way, this year's commencement address at UC Irvine will be delivered by a Kenyan-American named Obama. On the website of his university's School of Humanities, the listing of distinguished professors has Professor Ngugi as the first one on the list. The list is not alphabetical, so he is the most distinguished professor in the Humanities School at UC Irvine. I'll comment also, in his novels, of which he has published 7 to date, as well as 4 plays and about 7 or 8 collections of short stories and about 7 or 8 collections of essays, he is at his presence, his significance in African literature is as much attached to his essays as to his creative writing. For scholars like myself of African feminism, Ngugi's works have been noted for the strength of their representation of gender equilibrium and partnership, and particularly for the established agency of some and the development to agency of other female figures and their role in the consciousness raising of their population. And his most recent novel, Wizard of the Crow, is, in my opinion, his strongest achievement in this regard. Now, the evolution in Ngugi's subject matter, as the film showed, in his earliest novels, he was focusing on the anti-colonial struggle, and the later novels focus on the neo-colonial betrayal of the aspirations of the people. But in the evolution of his subject matter, or along with that, there has also been an evolution in the writing itself, particularly in his effort to adapt the European bourgeois modernist novel form to tell the Kenyan story. But also, it was during his detention for the calendar year 1978, during which he made his decision to write his works in Kikuyu, and so of his 7 novels, the last 3 have been written in Gikuyu, of which he has translated 2 himself. As I said, I think that the principle that drives Ngugi's activism is his conviction that a people's memory, which is the critical basis for their subjectivity, is preserved through their own language. Hence his own practice of writing in Gikuyu and his advocacy for the cultivation of other African languages for literary performance. This comes back to his insistence from the English Department Manifesto of the Abolition of the English Department on the realignment of perspective of the relationship between African people themselves and the rest of the world, i.e. their subjectivity. I think that we will hear in the conversation that follows that the advocacy of African languages is a struggle that is both political and cultural. And the title of his talk, The Barrel of a Pen, is, of course, from one of his essay collections from 1983, I think. Yes, 1983. That title is The Barrel of a Pen, Resistance to Repression in Neo-Colonial Kenya. So I think, as I said, that we will see that he views the struggle for the use of African languages as a struggle in which the writer, a political struggle in which the writer continues to be engaged. So it's my pleasure now to turn the conversation over. Dag will be the moderator, and we will be the beneficiaries.
Well, let me just say at the outset, what a rare privilege it is for me to moderate this discussion. Both Wachanga and Anne have made my job very easy, right? So I thought, you know, the difficulty of trying to facilitate a discussion with someone whose life and whose work refuses summation is, you know, 50 years of work, where to enter it? And I thought, why not begin today? The past few years have been very productive for you. And reading the three works that you've produced in 4 years alone, two memoirs, Dreams in a Time of War, a childhood memoir, and then following that up with In the House of the Interpreter, a memoir, Global Ethics, Theory and the Politics of Knowledge is also a kind of intellectual autobiography. If I were to identify an emergent late style in your work, it would be this retrospective turn. And this is something you actually say in the introduction to Global Ethics, the wonderful Kiswahili expression, ni mebwaga shumvi nyingi, I have eaten a lot of salt, which means that I have earned the right to look back and tell the tales of the past. So if you can tell us why this retrospective turn and the incredible how productive you've been putting together your memoirs.
So, thanking everybody for being here. You know, my son Mokoma here for using son-father relations to demand that I be here. But actually, I was very glad to come back to Canada. I've been here before. There have been a few benefits from that, you know, first of all of you being here, I think that wonderful introduction. And in terms of generation, I just want to just mention one person who is here in the audience, and that's Peya Soinka. Can you stand up? I'll tell a story about you, not about you in general, but can you stand up? Yeah. And Mokoma, can you stand up?
Right? You have to hold on to the mic.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I just wanted to, because I want to tell a tale of the past, you know, because they remind me, both of them, that she's the daughter of Wallace Soinka, of course, you know, and he's a son, my son. And he just reminded me to my memory lane, you know, traveling back to 1962, before both of them were born, I believe, when Wallace Soinka, Achebe, and all Kofi Oguna and all, you know, those writers of the continent who were writing at the time, young, optimistic, you know, dancers as well, you might say so, when we met Makerere. So that's a really, I'm meeting her for the first time, by the way. So it's wonderful to kind of give me a perspective, you know, from which to look back, you know, and I think in so many ways, be on behalf of my generation, we feel very proud that we have lived long enough to see the new generation take over. It's very wonderful. It's a kind of gift to ourselves, if I say so. Yeah. But the question of language, of course, you know, many things have been said. I mean, that's all very wonderful, Changa, the bring the debate, you know, to the fore, the different point of view. Because when it comes to language, there's not any one view. There are several voices, you know, it's a debate, you know, which goes on all the time. But I mean, it's just, it's not the only one which didn't come up with a discussion, and then I'll come back to this. The question of publishers. I believe many more Africans of the older and even younger generation, particularly, would be writing in African languages. But I've come to recognize that without a publishing venue, it's really very difficult. And since last year, or 3 years ago, from Cape Town, I've been talking about the need for African publishers or publishing African languages, you know, to come to the fore. Because no writer writes to put his manuscript in a shelf. You know, no matter how much you love Yoruba or Luo or Amharic, you don't write and then put the work in a shelf, you know, saying, oh yes, I did write in Amharic and so on. You want to publish, try it so that it can also be accessible. But there are very few publishers who are providing forum for writing in African languages. The third problem which we have seen is, quite frankly, African governments. African governments, the policies in Africa by African governments are actually basically anti-African languages. Or where they're not directly anti-African languages, they are neglectful. So we are in this very incredible situation where the majority of the people are taxed, whether you speak Yoruba or Igbo or Luo, so you are taxed. Everybody's taxed. But 90% of the resources that go for language arising from a collective taxation, 90% goes to English or French or Portuguese. Which means African language speakers are taxed so that European languages, Portuguese, English, and French can be enriched. So every single African language speaker contributes to this rather very unfair situation. And I think this needs to be really rectified, because without at least democratic government policies on language and education, we are putting an unfair burden on writers to write out our idealism, and then they have to keep their manuscript somewhere in their shelves and so on. But I really honestly believe there'll be many more writers. I know this because once I founded a Gikuyu journal called Motiri Yusho, you know, and I thought I would have had a lot of difficulties in getting people to write for it. No, on the contrary, you know, there are many more writers that I can actually handle in the journal. So I know it can be done, it has been done, and I'm sure even tomorrow, if African governments change their policies, you know, publishers and so on, you'd see a revolution in African language publishing. Having said that, we come to the memoirs. Now, I know Ricardi in the film raised a question as to return to English. slightly is incorrect a little bit, because I have not actually returned to English in a sense in which, the way in which it comes across. But I've been fairly pragmatic without losing my strategic aim. Tactically, I've, you know, become pragmatic a little bit in the sense that I've said, and I think I've been fairly consistent with this, all novels and fiction and poetry that I've written and published have been consistently in Gikuyu language first. Where I've really shifted here and there is a question of theory in Gikuyu. I have theoretical or explanatory prose and so on. I've generally written in English out of the same pragmatic, calculations, if you like. Although I did try once, like you mentioned that, sit in Germany when I gave a theoretical Gikuyu and raised that kind of tension. At the time, I did the same thing in Brussels once. I went there and spoke, it was a conference on African languages. And I said, it's a conference on African languages, then I'll speak in an African language and for you guys to provide interpreters, because you have provided interpreters for people speaking in Belgian, Polish, French, they are all these things, but you are discussing African languages. So once again, I spoke in Gikuyu in Brussels, and they had two translators, one from Gikuyu to English, and then from English into French, and so on. It's a bit tedious and so on, but I think it was worth, you know, making the point, yeah. So my memoirs, as part of that division, have been largely in English. And I've written two of them. Lately, my third memoir, Themes in a Time of War, and also In the House of the Interpreter. I just finished the manuscript for a third memoir, which tentatively I'm calling the, although my son doesn't like the title very much, but I'll say it, it's called The Birth of a Dreamweaver. You like the title, please raise your hand. Ah, Mokoma, you've been outvoted, eh? Yeah, so I'm doing that, you know, call it pragmatic, but basically one more pragmatics I'm doing right now. I'm also writing quite a lot of poetry in Gikuyu, because I found it's very personal, very personal. When some of my friends have passed away, including Mandela and others, I found it very difficult to write about them in English. And when Chinua passed away, I passed on, I wrote in Gikuyu about his passing on. I've done the same thing for Kofi, for Amir Baraka, Brutus, and others, as I find it comes known in a very personal way. I feel as if I've tried, but I cannot do it in any other language right now. I do it in a Gikuyu language. I'm also doing one more epic poem on my garden in California in a Gikuyu. And Hawaii and Poetry Review have just released their 97th edition, I think, and they have got my poem there in Gikuyu and also in English translation. So an issue they call and response. And I was responding to the Samoa novelist Albert Wendt when he and I met in Hawaii at a conference on the word in the world. And he wrote a poem about his garden in New Zealand, that his wife looked after or whatever, and I said jokingly, oh, then I'm going to tell you about my other garden. sort of in California, which my wife Jerry looks after our terror, you know. And when I went home, the Hawaiian Review, they told me, oh, by the way, we're bringing out an issue on call and response. We'd like to publish that poem of yours, which was the response to Albert Went. So once again, I had to come up with a with a poem, and it has been published in Gikuyu and also in English. So what I'm trying to say, I'm still soldiering on, you know, about languages, and I can only, I talk about theoretically, but also I like to show by example, right? But there are difficulties. I don't suggest it's a very easy path to take.
Could you just give us a sense of how you broke it up into a trilogy?
Oh, yes. Now, my memoirs are really about, I want to approach that first let me say this, because according with Wall Street, actually, you might want to hear this, you know, about that. For a long time, I could not write about my childhood. I never knew there was anything to talk about, really. And the reason I mentioned it was I remember once, you know, Wallace Schenker and I, and Dan Jacobson from South Africa, the novelist from South Africa, and other African writers were invited to an Afro-Scandinavian writers' conference. And each one of us was told to write about their childhood. I think Wallace Schenker wrote about his childhood, a little about their childhood. And Dan Jacobs did the same thing. But I just could not find anything to say about myself, my childhood. I really tried very hard, but it was impossible. In fact, I had to give them a chapter from my novel, A Grain of Wheat, which was really fictional, but I called it Memories of My Childhood, but meaning it was drawn from my childhood, okay? Memories, yeah. But now there came a time recently, about 3 or 4 years ago, when my wife Jerry told me about not the older kids like Mukoma, but the younger kids like Mombi. By the way, Mombi was South Africa with you. And Thiongo, who is now 18. And not only them, but also my grandchildren. Mukoma has some children, I've got some other kids who have, you know. And they want to know about you. Okay, what she was implying is, well, what she was implying, I'm getting on with years. I'm not becoming younger, kind of thing. This is what she was politely saying. So it's time you put your memories down. So I really give credit to my wife, Jerry, she's not here, but for that. And what I wanted to do, really, she's the one who helped me jog my memory. And what I wanted to write was how it felt like for it to grow up in Kenya, you know, in a time of war. Because I was born in 1938, literally on the eve of the Second World War. Then when the war ended by 1948-52, Mau Mau War for Liberation broke out. So born under the shadow of war, my youth was, you know, under the hail of bullets and so on, you know. So, but I was more interested in how it felt like to grow under those circumstances, right? And I continued the same strategy. Childhood is one natural break, you know, after when I go to high school. High school is another, you know, self-contained moment. And the last one, or I hope it's not the last anyway, the one which is just not yet published, is my Makerere years, you know. You know, it breaks down, almost like I'm following Wasonka's footsteps, you know. He has three, which ends. He has many more after that, but he has three, the first three at the end, Ake, and another one, and then Ibadan, and so on. Isar, yeah. So that's how they're kind of natural breaks. I don't know how to organize by other years. Now, just to to tell you the difficulties I'm having right now, those three volumes take me up to 1964. So I think there are 50 more years to come.
Wachanga, if I can turn this question, just if you can talk about the challenges of documenting someone, as you're documenting him, he's also in the process of documenting himself. You know, he said he's on his third, we might get more volumes. And I ask that in the sense that also the broader challenges of documenting someone like Ngugi, his own personal life, right, kind of illustrious life and career, but also the time he lived in. And this is what we glean from reading these memoirs, is that he has lived through some of the most pivotal epochal transformations in the 20th century. So I wonder how you try to tackle these larger-than-life themes, a larger-than-life figure, into the documentary form.
Well, thank you. It's a very challenging experience, because I'm not an expert on Ngugi. I have been depending on the conversations that I get from those who know him or those who are expert on his work. So what I have done is to talk to those who knew him when he was young. I have talked to those who were with him when he was at Makerere. I traveled to Leeds University, and Professor Martin Burnham, who, as a matter of fact, taught Wole Soyinka, but he did not teach Ngugi. So what he did is to construct for me the environment that was going on in England during that time. Professor Austin Bukenya, who teaches in Makerere, was at the University of Dar es Salaam before he went to England. As he was reflecting on their years in England, he said they were familiar with some of the canonical works written by the British. As a matter of fact, it is because of their excellence in interpreting those writers that they ended up in England to further their education. But once they get in England, they realize that some of the British students who were their classmates were not even familiar with that British literature. And the fact that Ngugi and his generation were, in a way, authoritative, and they understood that literature, the fact that they came from the continent, that diminished their credibility. And I do remember Austin Bukenya saying at one point, they started asking themselves, what has this education done to us? We came here because we thought we understood it, but here we are. Our roommates do not consider us to understand these novels, because for them, these are not even the novels that they are reading. So the other challenge was, so how is this education going to be important to us when we go back? So what that does to me, as someone who is interested in memory, is also the kind of education that we get when we leave the continent. And can we really set the agenda by living in the diaspora? But there's one more thing I want to touch on that Professor Ngugi said on indigenous languages. I interviewed the publisher of Africa, World Africa Press, Kasahun Chakole. His argument, even an economic argument for a publisher, was the opportunity Africans deny themselves by not engaging in the art of translation. That we have more than 2,000 African languages, what team we wrote in them and engaged in the art of translation. I talked to Wangui Wagoro, who has translated one of Ngugi's work, and she compared indigenous languages with indigenous trees. that if you're going to destroy all these indigenous trees, she made reference to Wangari Maathai, then we're going to have a desert. If we are going to not take care of indigenous languages, then we're going to have a linguistic desert. And it's not just Africa that is going to suffer, it is the entire humanity. But if I may, I would like to pose this question to Ngoge. When you engage in this art of translation as happened with a wizard of the crow, are these the same work? And do you do justice to your creative work when you translate it? And that is not my question. These are questions I got from Johannesburg.
First of all, of course, when you translate your own work, you are facing the same problems as any other translator, because every language has its own musicality. And one of the problems really in translation is how do you render musicality of one language into another? That's one of the difficulties. But then all translators have faced this difficulty, okay? And despite the difficulties of translation, even sometimes the inaccuracies of translation, in terms of the development of ideas, translations have had more impact, actually, than probably even original works in a specific language. I have in mind here, for instance, the global influence of the Bible. Both its impact, both on the development of European languages, German, English, and French, and you can see, how, for instance, Martin Luther's translation of the 99 Theses into German, and so how it completely revolutionized, German language, The same thing happened, with English and so on. Now, translation in the 16th century became so crucial. In fact, they regarded translation on the same level as piracy, just in the same way as people like Drake and Hawkins and other were knighted for stealing treasures from other European ships and so on. Translation was also regarded in the same way, like you're getting treasure from another language into, say, English or French and so on. And for those of you who are students of Shakespeare, for instance, you understand how much Shakespeare lives within a culture, even if an imagined, which accepted translation. You can see he assumed translation. Look at his setting of his plays, Macbeth, Scotland, Hamlet, Denmark. Look at Tempest, principalities come from Italy and so on. He's used translations to get some of those stories and so on, So translations have been, and also translations from the Greek and Latin and so on, Look at the influence of Karl Marx all over the world, the Mao debates, We know them largely through translations. So translations, even when they're not always accurate, have had that kind of impact on the development of, of ideas. So it may be problematic, and there are challenges for translating from Gikuyu into English. And there may be discrepancies here and there in terms of wording, phrasing. You may have to do a couple of sentences where you need only one word. Almost do one or two extra sentences to enable a certain concept to come through in English that was captured in one word or two words in Gikuyu. But this is also true. If you translate from Gikuyu, from English to Gikuyu, there's some words you can't simply put, you can't have a word for word equivalency. And so those are challenges of translation. What to me is important is the principle of translation as a means of enabling languages to speak to each other. Because we talk about multiplicity of African languages on the continent. That is true, we have so many of them. But for me, the more the merrier, actually, literally, you know. The problem really is, how do you then have dialogue among languages? And this, for me, this is where translation comes in. I've now defined translation as the language of languages. In other words, if languages spoke a language, a common language, that language would have the name translation in it, you know. So you ask me, what language do languages speak? They speak translation, right, yeah. So I think, for me, translation is very, very, very important. And I have tried to translate, I've translated two of Molière's plays through English into Ikoyo. And the humor comes across very greatly, you know. I still can't get a publisher to bring them out, but they are there in my show. I've translated Gogol, the inspector, or, you know, government inspector into Ikoyo. I still have it in my in my shelves, but it's done. It can be done, you know. So it's a really a question of what it came back to, question of policy and the demand by young people that we take a different, you know, direction. But let me speak to one thing. I'll be speaking to it directly. I think I better mention the question of what I've been calling metaphysical empires, the dominant metaphysical empire. It's Mokoma who drew my attention to the concept of metaphysical empire when he was doing some work at Isaac Johnson. And then he came across standardization of English, and then he came across an article written by Adam Bede, his Bede? Bede or something. And it was talking about how those who fought for the standardization of English saw it as important in creating a metaphysical empire which would outlive the physical. In fact, they saw the physical empire as coming to an end at some point. Then what is left would be metaphysical empire. So the physical empire comes to an end. What then remains a metaphysical empire. And I found this concept of metaphysical empire very useful in my analysis of language power relationship in the world today. And then I realized it's a post-colonial phenomenon. It's not even just an African phenomenon. Because to trace this phenomenon, you go through Ireland, Gaelic and English. And where the Gaelic was, in the 7th century or 6th century, was a more advanced language in terms of literature and history. Not English, always the Indian language, it was actually Gaelic, you know. But then you see how the power relations changed between Gaelic and English. The same thing, you trace the whole phenomenon through Wales as well. You know, how were the Welsh going to lose their language? Through Scotland, okay, the same thing. Through Africa. Now, two things happen. There's one common in all those situations. One is how English language, for instance, was transmitted to, say, to the Irish, to the Scottish, to Africa, through beating, those corporal punishment. Okay? Anybody caught speaking, say, in my own case, an African language in the school compound, they were humiliated. They were to swallow some dirty things or carry some little thing here saying I'm an idiot or I'm stupid and so on. Sometimes they'd be made to stand in front of all their kids so that people are, yeah, yeah, yeah. this one who speaks African language, you know, right? And the same thing happened in the Wales. Government carried a little something here to say the Welsh not. Now, then, but when you did well in English, it was praise, it was intelligence, power. Look at how you are unwanted, you know. This, I don't want to go into psychology, but this has to do also with the psychology of behavior, what they call behaviorism, okay? Where systems of reward and punishment mean a certain behavior are reinforced and others are discouraged, okay? Skinner, actually, you read Skinner, you know, behaviorism, okay? And it corresponds very well to this punishment for African languages, reward for European languages. But to bring something else also, the whole idea of if you put your finger somewhere and you are burnt, something you don't even discuss in the memory, you don't even think about it anymore. You just know instinctively, you don't put your fingers there because they are burnt. Okay? It's the Pavlovian idea that, you know, the experiment Pavlov, you know, sound, food, and then later you want to do the sound and salivation, the dog salivates. It's the same thing, you know. You've been punished so much in the case of African languages that when you hear the sound of an African language, pain comes in. So you avoid it instinctively, and you don't even think about it anymore. You normalize it, no. Huh? And the sound of English or French, it salivates intelligence. You salivate intelligence, normality, complexity, and then I suddenly you just play it instinctively. You don't even think about why you're automatically choosing one and avoiding one and the other. You know, because it's called your conditioning. You are conditioned to accept something as norms and others. So I'm saying this conditioning was a process by which people came to be socialized into thinking and taking for granted that human beings are the norm and the others are not quite. There may be other factors. But I believe the question of metaphysical empire is rooted in a system of humiliation, negativity in the case of African languages, and glory and heaven in the case of the other. Even when they teach African languages, as I keep on saying, it's like, you know, sometimes they have African language in school for 3 years, like in our case. But even then, African languages are seen as the, you know, a ladder has different rungs. Huh? They see African languages as lower rung on the ladder to English heaven. Okay. In that system, heaven has English zones, French zone, and Portuguese zone, but alas, there's no. So you won't go to heaven. Well, you just use African language only as a step. Otherwise, you abandon them all together. Yes.
Okay. Well, related to that, following up with translation, I think what's so unique about your work is that in addition to being an extraordinary artist, novelist, dramatist, poet, now memoirist, you've also produced an extraordinary body of scholarship. And I wonder if you can talk to us about that. So from the Manifesto on the Abolition of the English Department to Globalectics. And what I find interesting is that you're writing Globalectics at the same time you're writing something, quote unquote, more creative. And they're both fluent in the genre, in that particular genre. So I wonder how you've always reconciled the scholarly work and quote unquote the creative enterprise?
Well, I don't even recognize that they're part of me, you know, and I think Mokoma is fighting the same person. I don't know, it's a good problem to have, correct, Mokoma?
It's an excellent problem.
Oh, okay. Because they kind of go together. But in my own case, they arise from the same, my activism, you might call it that way, language, writing, and so on, really arise from this. For me, it's actually very simple, you know, put that way, that we have to learn that our starting point is not a problem. What do I mean by that? Colonialism tried to make people's starting point as a problem unto themselves. You know, they tried to make people believe that Europe was the starting point, was the universal starting point. So if you're in Africa, you find a way of being in Europe, not in the physically, metaphysically, as you're starting point, link yourself to English or French as your starting point. But my belief, I'm serious about that, wherever we are, Europe, Asia, wherever you are, that's the center of the world. You know, you can go to the world, that's your starting point. It's not a problem. If I'm born in Kenya, I don't want anybody to make my being born in Kenya a problem to me. Right? If I'm born black, I don't want anybody to make me believe my blackness a problem. And why should I accept it? It's just my starting point. It's what I do with it. You know, if you're born into wealth, for that matter, I don't need you to feel guilty about it. It's what you do with it. If you're born white, it's not a problem, right? Don't make anyone make it, it's a problem. Just, it's your starting point, it's what you do with it. Right? Whatever condition of life you're born into, unless you made an application before you are born, right? And said, please, can I be born white? Please, can I be born black? Please, can I be born wealthy or whatever? But if you had no hand in choosing that condition, then don't let anyone make it a problem. It's your starting point, what you do with it, choices you make, that's really what is important, not that my, I don't want anybody to make my color, skin color, a problem for me. I don't want anybody to make my hair, even if I don't want to comb it, you know. I don't want to be a problem, right? You know, it's not a problem. It's what I do with it. You can say, did you comment or did you not comment? But not the fact that it's curly. And, you know, and I use the word curly, by the way, very carefully, because I once made a mistake in how I don't know how I was talking to. I was praising my hair, but I was talking about kinky hair, and this lady took me aside. Never you call our hair kinky again. It's double curly. Can't you see? So now I never talk about kinky hair or something. It's double curly or triple, multiple curly hair. Like why? Anyway, what am I trying to say? Is it? The problem with system of domination is trying to make people feel they are a problem, that they themselves are a problem. And my whole aesthetics and so on is to say, no, no, I am not a problem. Okay? I was born in Limuru, I did not apply to be born in Limuru, that's my starting point. But I also believe that from Limuru where I was born, I can rise to wherever. I can reach wherever I can. So to me, that's very, very important. When we did theater in Kenya, it was the same principle. I said, no, from our own land, even though we don't even have to go to the university, from the village, we can create a theater which will be the envy. You know, from Nairobi, other places will come to this village here to watch people doing this theater. Okay? Okay. To me, that was very important. I believe the same way. I want to write in an African language and reach the highest possible in an African language. Whatever it is, the crow, which you had mentioned, you know, I really wanted the Igbo people to laugh. So these days, people who read it in English, I ask them, when they tell me I read your book, yeah, I ask them, the first question I ask, did you laugh? And they say, yes, I laughed. I say, that's good, I'm satisfied. Right, yeah. So really, it's a question of that whatever I am, whether my color, my language, my history, my mother, my father, those are my starting points. What I do with that is enough. You can judge me on what I do, the choices I make. Yeah, it's fair. But you cannot tell me to turn around and say that being an African is a problem, having this kind of hair is a problem. And I started worrying about it myself. I go to get Ambi to get clean up my skin. Why? Yeah. Or anybody else for that matter. If you're born white, it's not a problem. Just, you didn't apply, right? But it's not, it doesn't mean one thing or another. It's neither privilege nor disprivilege. It's a fact. What choices you make with that, a different matter. Yeah.
Well, I'm being told that we are running out of time. I have too many questions. I won't be greedy, and in the time we have left, maybe we can take one or two questions from the audience.
Could you talk a little about the role of publishing children's literature and textbooks in their own languages, and how the government does or doesn't work with that?
Yeah. It doesn't, so a question of government, I mean, we are in a, it's a struggle all over again in the case of Africa, because the, you know, when I watch my grandchildren are growing, I must say, confess largely through Skype technology. I've got a granddaughter in Helsinki and two others in New York, you know, and I, through Skype, I can, you know, play with them. Sometimes I just enjoy the way that they begin to speak. They said they like to play with sounds. It's not even with words in their meaning, but it's just sounds. You know, they are playing, you know, they begin to play with sounds and so on, you know. Now, of course, later those sounds are organized in a linguistic structure or whatever, you know. So it's very important for us in Africa to be producing books and pictures that show the world to an African child in their own languages. Because if they can grasp the world through their own languages, they'll be more confident in adding other languages. So you're more confident when you know where you are starting, right? If you don't know where I am, how do I be confident about where I'm going to, right? You know, if I like to give this example, if I might digress a bit, I'm a storyteller, so please forgive me. But I was thinking that if I came to Carnell and I got lost somewhere and I called my son, you know, oh, come on, I'm going to New York. I am lost. Where the first thing he'll ask me, Daddy, don't worry, or Pops as they call me, or sometimes they call me old man, Kaze. Kaze is a little old man. He's coming. Now, the first thing he'd ask me, don't worry, Daddy, where are you? Okay? Describe to me where you are right now, then I'll direct you to come to me. Suppose I tell him I don't know where I am. How did he even direct me to where he is? Does he know whether I'm still in California or here in New York or whatever? I would have to be able to actually describe to him where I am. He might even just look around you, just describe what's around you, whatever it is, please. that describe it. Okay? If I say, I cannot describe anything, then he, no matter how much he may love me and his dad and so on, unless he gets a helicopter to go around the whole world looking for me, you know, it, but if I tell him where I am, if I know where I am at that moment, say, he is here, there is this around me, there is what is around me, then he, ah, in that case, either stay there, come for you, or do A, B, C, D. So to know where you are, you know, becomes, you know, for me, you know, well, how to put it, you know, very, very important. And really, if I said anything today, really, it should be anything meaningful is about our starting point, you know, to know where one is, to be able to move to wherever we can. And there's no place we cannot move to. We can go to Mars, even or beyond. But we must know where, in going to Mars, where we're launching ourselves from, right?
Yeah. We'll take another question. And this is a point that it's elaborated in Globalectics, a point of departure, as you say. So buy that book and read it.
Oh, yeah, Globalectics. I might recommend one of my books if you want. No, but seriously, Global Ethics summed up. I can sum it for you. Don't read it. I'll sum it for you right now. It's from expansion, really. Or you know the English poet Blake. You know, I think it's a marriage of heaven and hell, because he liked to write poems which, you know, yoke together contradictions and so on. It's incredible. But he talked about seeing the world in a grain of sand, eternity in an hour. That's Globalectics, as summed up by Blake.
How did you write in prison? What happens to the art when everything is against you? How do you work through that?
Again, she's asked me, because when I was in prison, I wrote my first novel in Kuala, not in English, when I was in prison.
On toilet paper.
On toilet paper, even that. I should have brought a piece of it, actually. Right. The first of all, let me just say this, very important for me, because it tells my aesthetics. I believe there's beauty, or let me give this example. If somebody comes and gives, someone who does like you or gives you a blow, and then you fall down, do you say, oh, you just preach to him, oh, by the way, that's morally very bad. But that's what he wanted to do anyway, in the first instance, to knock you down. So you don't say, oh, please, can you lift me up? But why should he lift you up when he's the one who knocked you down in the first instance, right? What you do, you stand up. And if it does again, you stand up again. No matter, the last thing you want to do is accept to stay on the floor, because that's where he intended to be. So you must find, even if you don't have anything, the last ounce is try, for as long as you can rise, you try and do it, okay? Because that embodies the aesthetics of resistance. And for me, the fact that I was in prison for writing an African language, in a maximum security prison, you know, you try, use all strategies. For me, writing in Kikuyu was very, very important. For me, it was like this. You put me in prison, maximum, because I wrote in an African language. Now here, the pleasure I'm going to get is here in this prison, writing in the very language of my income that made me, you incarcerate me. And what more, you deny me paper, I'm going to use the paper, you're going to supply me with the paper, and you're going to supply me with the pen. Yeah? And you have guards on every door, right? So I was guarded, I had toilet paper for writing material, and for pen, you said you're going to confess your sins to the authorities. Whatever those sins were, they gave you a pen, a little bit. So I said, I'm going to confess my sins, you know. So I wrote one sentence of confession and put it on my desk there. The rest I wrote the novel. What I'm trying to say really is that whatever you don't, I mean, history shows us people don't have always tried to rise up, you know, you don't accept to be where your enemy wants you to be. Because if you are there, then he's very happy. Right? If somebody says you are a slave and you accept you are a slave, then he doesn't need policemen. You know, you accept it, right? You know. But if you say no, to me the word no then becomes very, very important as a point of departure. This is why I came to write in prison and I used toilet paper. There are problems, of course, I'm not saying it was easy and so on. But you know, it worked for me, right? And the result was the novel, Devil on the Cross, which by the way was the first novel in Gikuyu. So a novel written in prison became the founding text of modern Gikuyu literature.
Let me take the mic from you now. Yeah, no, it just occurred to me since we have talked a lot about African languages, this might be a good time to announce that that we have found some money for a Kiswahili prize. This will be through the Mabati Foundation. It's a roofing company, so literally they'll be providing a roof for Kiswahili. So we're starting a Kiswahili prize. So we have a good chunk of the money, but I'll be knocking on your doors, or even better, come to me. Yep.
Well, there's a reception to follow, and you wanted to ask them? Okay, you will have the last word, please.
Good evening again, sir. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. Kind of a political scientist, so I want to ask you a little bit. You spoke about demanding. The government policies changing, publishers, but also the demand. So I'm kind of trying to pick your brains a little bit. If you were, for example, the Minister of Education, Kenya or any country like Nigeria, I want to know what policy, what would be the demands that you'd be pushing for from that angle in order to transform or make real some of these ideas about the changes. And I'm asking because you spoke a lot about searching for a liberating space. Last year, Ithaca College sent around a government policy, some document, and then they said at the foot of the document, they said, you have the right to have this translated into your language. So for the first time in 15 years, I wrote back and I said, I do need to have this in Yoruba. And so the college kind of went a little crazy, and after 2 weeks, the director wrote me and said, Pei, we're really sorry. Do you mind having it in French or any other language? We don't have any translation. So I'm asking, what is it that we are demanding if it was policy?
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, very right. You know, like she mentioned when I was in Germany saying, look, use a Swedish language. You actually go out of their way to get a translator. Use a Swedish writer was actually there. You try to get a translator. Put it in German and also into English. When it comes to Africa, it is for granted you don't have to do anything because an African will bring himself to your position and so on. You know what I'm saying is, you know, if I was Minister, say of Education or for that matter, you know, are you going to be the president of Nigeria? Because if you're going to be, then I like to be assured of that post. You know, really. Just go back. I wish people would go to the basics, really. And the basics is nothing more than what I've been saying. You know, find policies that mean starting with ourselves. For instance, if I was to get, say, a story, see, I was minister not only just of Kenya, but of Africa as a whole, Minister of Education in Africa, you get, say, a story written, say, in Yoruba, a good story. Mm-hmm. Or there's a story written in Yoruba. Imagine in that story in Yoruba, with Yoruba characters, what was available in Gikuyu. So I coach a reading that Yoruba story, Yoruba names become names with which she becomes or he becomes familiar in Gikuyu. And you see, and you multiply that story, not just in Gikuyu, available in his Zulu, available in his Xhosa, in Kiswahili, and so on. So through that one story only, which are Yoruba names, Yoruba characters, eh? But now through translation, and Yoruba's more or life or whatever, you know, translated is appropriated by a Gikuyu, an Amharic speaker, an Igbo speaker, and so on. And the other way around, I started the origin is Amharic, say, you know, finds characters, you know, that are read by an Isuzu child, okay? Imagine the dialogue that this ensues when children identify, because you identify with some characters, good characters or bad characters or heroic characters, you know. So you get a good child identify with a heroic character who is Yoruba, a heroic character who is Zulu or dislike a character who, a bad person who happened to be Zulu speaker or who speak or whatever, you know. This surely, even at a very preliminary level, would be so much dialogue. And yet we don't even have how to preach to anybody. You know. And you know, we can learn a lot from, I'm not a very good Christian myself. I have to confess to you. In fact, I'm not a Christian at all. But let me tell you, we can learn from the Bible. Because the missionaries were very smart. They made the Bible available in many African languages. So you are Christian, you read the Bible in in fact, yesterday I was when I was waiting for the plane, which was delayed, I was sitting next to a Japanese, and she's Japanese American. And of course she was reading something written in Japanese, but which looked, she looked up, so I said, what book are you reading? Oh, is the Bible in Chinese characters, right? Now, so we can learn a lot from that, meaning that one is still reading a Christian message, but expressed in their own different languages, right? So their Christian behavior, if you like, is more or less the same, although expressed in different languages, you know. So the same way we can, there are things we can actually do practically, you know. And for a change as a minister, I would demand that if 50% of resources that go to languages, at least I would demand that at least 50% of it also goes to African languages, and the other 50 to whatever is the national official language, at the very least, right there, right? Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.